We're back on Veterans Radio, and want to welcome all those troops that are listening overseas. You know, that thin green and blue line is preserving our freedom. Us older troops really, really admire the job you're doing. You're very good at your craft. To our veteran brothers and sisters, welcome home. And to the folks down under in both continents, the Australian and the South American continent. We know we've got listeners in South America now, too. Welcome to Veterans Radio. And also, Joe Galloway, welcome to Veterans Radio. You guys make me push the buttons, and you got to teach me to be a technician here. Joe Galloway, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Gary. Always good to talk to you.
Oh, it's fun. It's my pleasure. Joe, you've covered more than the Vietnam War. You've covered a lot of them. And one of the, how did you start in as a journalist? Did you take training, or is this something that you just jumped into?
Oh, no. I think I must have been born one. I worked on the school newspaper in high school, helped start a competition weekly in my hometown the summer I got out of high school, and went off briefly to college, and I was driven out by an 8 a.m. class in the German language taught by a portly lady with badly fitting dentures. She would come in the morning and say Guten Tag and spray the first three rows. And I couldn't bear it any longer, and I was on my way to join the Army. I was 17. I had browbeat my mother into agreeing to sign for me, and we were two blocks from the recruiting office in Victoria, Texas, when we passed the newspaper, and Mom, God rest her, said, Joe, what about your journalism? And I said, good call, Mom, stop the car. And I had been their campus stringer for those few weeks, and I walked in and asked the editor if he had a job, and he did, and he hired me on the spot for $35 a week and a free subscription to the paper, and I was on my way.
One single line changed your life.
That's it.
Isn't that amazing? Who knows what might have happened if you had finished the trip and gone in the Army?
I'd have probably been killed in Vietnam.
Well, glad you weren't. You volunteered for Vietnam. In fact, you sent a letter a week. I was doing the same thing over. I was stationed in a California base, and I was hounded the personnel office to get me orders to a battalion going to Vietnam, which shows you how insane you can be at times.
Absolutely, it's a good thing we were young.
That's why they like young people in the military.
That's right.
You were a journalist elsewhere, but then you did hound to get over to Vietnam, and then finally got your wish, ended up in Vietnam. Give us a little bit of a history on your first, 48, 72 hours in country?
Well, I landed about 2 weeks after the Marines, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, landed in Da Nang. In March of 1965, I landed in April, coming from Tokyo. I'd sort of made a stop there for 6 months, but I always knew where I was going, and knew I would get there, and got to Saigon on a flight. My seatmate was a little Buddhist monk in orange robes, and the closer we got to Saigon, the more he was talking about sticking to me like glue. And I wondered what the hell was going on, and we landed, and they told everybody to remain in their seats, and a squad of white mice, the Saigon police, got aboard and yanked that guy, that Buddhist monk, out of his seat and drug him down the aisle and down the stairs. And he was one of those exiles who was trying to slip back in the country, and he failed utterly. They put him on the next plane back out. And that was my arrival in Vietnam. And
welcome to democracy.
Welcome to democracy, and I reported in to the old United Press International Bureau, and had a day or two in Saigon to get my press card from MACV, and then I got on the mail run C-123 that ran from Saigon, Tonsonut, it landed in Pleiku, and then it went to Fubai, and then it came back to Da Nang, and
That's that little twin engine. Is it a Caribou, the 123?
No, the 123 is a bit bigger than the Caribou.
Okay.
The Caribou was operated by the Army. The 123 was the workhorse, the pre-C-130.
Oh, okay.
And they carried the mail and carried people around. They ran two or three of these flights a day. And
the FedEx of the military.
Took forever to get there, but eventually I made it to Da Nang. And by then the Marines had taken over a former merchant marine brothel on the banks of the Da Nang River and turned it into a press center. I suppose someone thought that was appropriate. And
knowing the reputation of correspondents, right?
Yeah. And so that was it. I had a rented Jeep, and I lived in Da Nang for 6-7 months, I guess. I would be up there for 2-3 months at a time before I would even get back to Saigon. They packaged up mail and sent me bundles of piastres to pay my bills with, and I went on every operation the Marines made.
I was just going to say, you weren't one of those correspondents that reported the war by sitting back in an air-conditioned building and listening to news releases. You were
out there in the field with
the grunts.
I had, when I was younger, I had read the collected works of Ernie Pyle in World War II, and I decided then if there was a war during my generation, I wanted to cover it, and if I covered it, I wanted to cover it like Pyle covered his generation. That's up front with the troops, and that's precisely what I did.
You did
like
a little
Saigon.
Better job of surviving than Ernie Pyle.
I didn't like Saigon, and I didn't like the politics of the situation. And, you know, I would get to Saigon once in a while, and most of the 500-plus accredited correspondents spent their time in Saigon, and they went to the daily briefings. We called them the 5 o'clock follies. And they would complain to me, you know, they're lying to us. And my answer was always the same. You know, no one lies to you within the sound of the guns. You come out with me and people will tell you the truth. Of course, you may get killed.
Tell us about your first time that you went out with the troops.
Well, on the day I arrived, I got off that plane, there was a fellow came running up to me and said, "You are Monsieur Galloway?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I am Henri Huet. I work for UPI. There is big trouble. Come with me." And I was carrying a Samsonite suitcase and still wearing chinos and loafers. I hadn't even gotten a set of fatigues yet. And I said, "What about my suitcase?" And he said something rude about it and threw it in the 8th Aerial Transport Squadron hooch there at Da Nang and drug me onto a C-130 that was spinning up on the ramp. And I didn't know where I was going or what was going on, and we made a short flight, and we landed in a place called Quang Ngai City. And we got off, and it was like someone had stirred an anthill. They were under serious attack and serious pressure in that area. And it was an early attempt by the Viet Cong to cut the country in half. And I got off, and there's confusion all around, planes and choppers coming and going, and people running around, and this little photographer ran off to a Marine H-34 old titanium magnesium-based skinned aircraft helicopter, and he talked to the crew chief, and then he waved at me, and the next thing I know, I'm on this bird, and we're flying out low level across the paddies, and I still don't know where I am, and I still don't know where I'm going, and this helicopter finally comes upon a hill. It rises out of the rice paddies, and it circled around this hill, and I'm trying to look out the door, and I can see that there are a lot of people on top of this hill. And we land there, and they shut down, and there is dead silence. And I mean that literally. I got out of the bird, and then I was told why they were giving us this ride. They needed our help. A battalion of South Vietnamese had been overrun and killed to the last man. And we were there to help them find and bring back the bodies of the two American advisors. These Arvin were, they had only time to just sort of scratch out a little body depression in the ground, and every man was laying where he had made his last stand, hands out like he was holding a rifle, but the rifle was gone, and we went hole to hole until we found the two Americans and carried them back to the helicopter. It was a very sobering welcome to Vietnam.
That was on your first day?
Yeah.
It teaches you what war is real fast. I can't imagine that. I remember my first day when they had to stop firing the artillery at either end of the Chulai airstrip to let a plane in, and then they'd start again, and then when the plane was taking off, they'd stop firing. And, you know, we've got 105s, you know, barrels pointed up in the air and blasting away on all three sides. And I thought, well, this is a war. This is for real.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. You had a little bit more of an awakening. You've spent so much time in war that when the troops were getting ready to go into Iraq in the invasion, Knight Ridder newspapers asked you to write a memo to the correspondents that would be traveling along with them, and to give them advice. And in reading your memo, it was amazing, down to the simple things. A big neckerchief. Tell us why they would want a big neckerchief.
Oh, well, you need to bathe in it, for one thing. It's your towel, it's your neck rag, it's but mainly in the desert, you wear it across your face like a bank robber, to keep the sand out of your mouth.
Okay. A good set of earplugs.
Well, you know, you ride helicopters a lot in a combat operation, and they're bad on your ears. I'm probably half deaf anyway, if not three quarters, and it's all because of loud noises in my youth.
You said do not stand near an Abrams tank or 155-millimeter howitzers. You may hurt yourself jumping when they go off.
Absolutely.
and believe me, I did that the first time a 155 fired over my head and wasn't ready for it. You said if things start happening, if anyone tells you to move out or run or dig a hole, do so with vigor.
Yes, indeed. And if stuff starts coming in and things start blowing up and you don't know what to do, find someone with stripes on his arm and do what he does.
One of the things you said in combat, you may find that they need a helping hand. You've done this a lot. So you said carry water or ammo or the dead if needed.
That's correct. and I've done all of those things. You got to make yourself of some use besides standing around like a bump on the log.
When you first got to Vietnam, you were also carrying a weapon. How did that happen?
Well, not when I first got there, but not long after. There were battalion commanders who would tell you straight up, look here, I don't have the spare bodies to give you your personal bodyguard. You got to take care of yourself. If you're not carrying a weapon, you can't march with my outfit. Second of all, in spite of the fact that you carried a press card and it had real fine print on the back of it that said that you were to be treated with all the privileges afforded a major in the U.S. Army if you were captured by enemies of the United States, I didn't recall that they were very kind to anyone of any rank if you fell into the hands of our enemies right. In that place. And besides, they were shooting at me. And I felt obliged on occasion to shoot back.
We're coming up on a break, and we're going to pick that up again. And the people that you met and the ones that had you firing weapons. You're listening to Veterans Radio. You're listening to Joe Galloway, war correspondent. We'll be back right after this break. And we're back on Veterans Radio with Joe Galloway, who is absolutely the Ernie Pyle of our generation, and that's quite a compliment. Joe Galloway was the correspondent that covered wars and was a friend to the grunt. He was a friend to the infantryman and to all military. Joe, we left you the last half hour at getting your first weapon, and after that you went to the Play Me Special Forces camp and met up with a Major Beckwith and got an even more powerful weapon. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, that, Gary, was an interesting time. It was third week of October 1965, and the Play Me camp was under siege by a regiment of North Vietnamese, and they were kind of holding the camp hostage as a dangling bait to draw a South Vietnamese armored column up the road to rescue them, and then they had another regiment standing by to ambush them. And I wanted to get in there, and the airspace was closed. A couple of Hueys had been shot down, a Sky Raider and a Canberra bomber. The place was ringed with those 51 caliber Chinese anti-aircraft machine guns on tripods, and they were looking down our throats, and I was stomping up and down the flight line at Camp Holloway, saying rude words and things, and I ran across an old Texas Aggie helicopter pilot, a Huey pilot with the 119th helicopter company. And he said, "What's the matter, Joe?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to get into Play Me camp, and there's no way to go." And he said, "Let me get the clipboard." He took a look. He said, "Well," he said, "the reason you can't get in there is the airspace is closed." And I said, "I know that, dummy, but I still want in there." And he said, "Well, I wouldn't mind taking a look, so I'll give you a ride." And Ray Burns flew me in there. He hit the ground. I took a picture. You know, we were sort of corkscrewing, if you can do that in a Huey, to avoid those machine guns, and dropping in as fast as he could. And I shot a picture out the open doorway, and you can see the triangular-shaped camp filling that doorway in that picture. And you can see the smoke from the mortar bombs going off, and that's where we were headed.
I've seen that photograph, and it's exactly as you describe it.
Exactly. You know, there's no one in his right mind would want to go there, but who said I was in my right mind? I was 23 years old, and I thought I was immortal and bulletproof.
Apparently, well, your helicopter pilot did, too.
Yeah, well, he was the same way. He was Texas Aggie and an old buddy and a we played poker and drank whiskey together, and he didn't mind putting it on the line, and so he dropped that thing in. I bailed out. They threw some wounded aboard, and off he went, you know, and this master sergeant, Special Forces, came running up to me, and he said, "Sir," he said, "I don't know who the hell you are, but Major Beckwith wants to speak to you right away." And I said, "Which one is he?" And he said, "It's that big guy over there jumping up and down on his hat." And I thought, that doesn't bode well, but I went over, and he said, you know, a lot of rude words we can't say on this network, but he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a reporter." And he said, "You know, I need everything in the whole blankety-blank world. I need medevac, I need food, I could use reinforcements, I need ammo." He said, "I need everything. I could use a bottle of Jim Beam and a box of cigars, and what has the Army in its wisdom sent me but a blankety-blank reporter?" He said, I got to tell you, son, I have no vacancy for a reporter, but I'm in desperate need of a corner machine gunner, and you're it." And I was, my mouth was hanging open by then. And
Geneva Convention.
Well, that was not going to work with Sergeant Charlie Beckwith, who was later the founder of the Delta Force. And he hauled me over to a position, and there was an air-cooled 30 caliber machine gun sitting there. He showed me how to load it and how to clear a jam, and he gave me my instructions, which was I should shoot all the little brown men outside the wire, but not the ones inside the wire. They belong to him. And he said, "While you're at it," he said, "keep one eye always on that machine gun position down in the other corner of the camp, because it's manned by a South Vietnamese CIDG. They're infiltrated. I don't trust them as far as I can throw them. And if you see them turn that machine gun around, take them out."
And those things happened quite a bit in those days, or all throughout the war, didn't they?
They did. They did. And so I spent, I think, 3 days and three nights on that machine gun, and it was what you call sporty times. And finally, the armored column made it through the ambush, thanks to the 1st Cav hopscotching artillery batteries with, you know, slung beneath Chinooks. And this was something new in this war. And the North Vietnamese didn't know about it, and when they snapped their ambush, they got hammered by precise artillery fire, and they got hammered by a whole world of air.
Well, these were tactics that they used against the French quite successfully, setting up a bait like the Pligny camp, not taking it on purpose, and setting up ambushes to wipe out the column.
You bet. And the one thing that was different here was that the 1st Cavalry Division had arrived. They had 435 helicopters in their TONE, and they could do this. They could provide, they could guarantee that South Vietnamese armor commander was refusing to leave Pleiku until the Cav guaranteed he would be under an umbrella of artillery protection every mile of the way. And so they pulled in, and about then a battalion of the 1st Cav did an air assault landing there and were marching off to clear the hills around the camp.
Who was in command of that unit?
I don't remember which battalion it was.
Okay.
But I went to Major Beckwith and said my goodbyes, and he said, "Son, you're not carrying a piece." And I said, "Well, you know, technically speaking, I'm a civilian non-combatant under the Geneva Conventions, and in spite of the use you've made of me these last 3 days and nights." He said, "There's no such thing in these mountains, son." He said, Master Sergeant, get the man a rifle and a bag of magazines. And so I marched out of there with an M16 on my shoulder and a sack of magazines fully loaded. And 3 weeks later, I would thank my lucky stars and thank Charlie Beckwith, who was a friend of mine to his last days, for that rifle.
And when you got off into the hills, what did you find?
Oh, incredible. The hills were stripped of vegetation. There were a few trees still standing, most of the branches gone, all of the leaves gone. The soil looked like it had been plowed by a giant plow or something. Nothing was left unturned, untouched, and we found North Vietnamese machine gunners' bodies with a leg chained to the tripod of their gun. And later, I had occasion to interview General An, who was the tactical commander at X-Ray and in this fight, too. And I asked him about that, and he said,
General An commanded the other side, the North Vietnamese.
On the other side, yeah, right. The North Vietnamese. And okay. So first chance I got, we interviewed him three times. I asked him about that, and he... You know, he tried to sort of avoid the question, but I pushed. I tend to do that. And he said, look, it was a 32nd regiment, and they were fairly green, and we knew they were going to be subject to heavy, heavy air attack, and we were afraid they would run, so we just fixed it so they couldn't. And those guys stayed with their guns and died with their guns.
Well, that's something, of course, you'll never see in the military, the American military. But we covered the Battle of LZ X-Ray before, but I've had a lot of requests, and we've got about a minute and a half for this. In the movie, Sergeant Major Plumley came up to you when you were hugging the ground under fire, and what did he do? People have asked me, did that really happen?
Absolutely. Just as it was in the movie. I'm laying there feathering out at the edges, staying real low. There's a world of fire coming right through the command post area, and I can't get low enough. And about then I feel a thump in my ribs, and I carefully turn my head without lifting it to see what it is. And what it is a size 12 combat boot on the foot of Sergeant Major Plumley.
I know it.
Bear of a man out of West Virginia, and a three-war man, too, bent over at the waist, and over this din of battle, he shouted down at me. He said, can't take no pictures laying there on the ground, sonny.
and that was portrayed in the movie, and I wondered it myself. Did it really happen? And you say it did happen.
Absolutely, and, you know, I lay there, and I thought, well, he's right. Later on, I would learn that sergeants major are always right. And like a fool, I got up and I thought, you know, yep. It seems to me maybe we're all going to die here today. And if I'm going to get mine, I'd rather take it standing alongside a man Basil Plummer.
We'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio and the Veterans Radio Network, coming to you from our flagship station, WDEO in Ann Arbor, on Ave Maria Radio. We're talking to Joe Galloway, war correspondent, recently retired. But, Joe, you covered more wars and more battles than who was it said you have more time in combat than any infantryman? General.
I think that was General Barry McCaffrey.
And he's right, correct?
I don't know. You know, there's a lot of guys with a lot of time in combat now.
True.
With 3-4 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I don't know if that stands or not.
Well, you stand up there.
I'm happy to let that record go right. To somebody else.
You're in the top 10%, and I understand why you're happy to let somebody else have that record. So you did some more tours of Vietnam. After that first tour, was the not the highlight, but the whatever you want to call it, the Battle of LZ X-Ray, or were there other battles in that first tour that, you know, equaled it?
Oh, none that ever equaled it, not in that tour or three other tours that I pulled in Vietnam, not in half a dozen other wars I've covered. That was a high water mark, and it was the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War. Right then, right there, 305 American boys killed in that campaign. Hundreds and hundreds wounded. Just a, you know, a ferocious collision between the two finest light infantry outfits operating in the world.
And I've heard
the Vietnamese Army and the 1st Cavalry Division.
And I've heard many a grunt say that the North Vietnamese Army, their troops were very good at what they did, well trained, well armed, well equipped, and dedicated.
Absolutely, and you know, they weren't afraid to die. They had to walk to work through a firestorm just to get to us, and they didn't flinch.
And going back,
they were superb infantry fighters, and anyone who didn't respect that enemy in Vietnam was an absolute fool.
Or dead.
Or dead. Or both.
Or both. Yep. The politics aside, when you left Vietnam for the last time, what was your impression? What was your impression of the American soldier?
Oh, my impression of the American soldier in Vietnam in 1965, 71, 73, of the American soldier in the Gulf War, in Haiti, in two tours in Iraq, I have the highest respect for. And, you know, there's a difference between soldiers who fought in Vietnam, the draftee army, and those who fight today in Iraq and Afghanistan, the volunteer army. You know, these kids are more sophisticated, they're better educated, they're better trained, and certainly better armed. But, you know, soldiering comes down to a matter of the heart.
Yep.
And that's unchanging. I think it's never changed from the first day a guy picked up a rock to defend his cave and his wife and his kids 10,000 years ago. There is a sense about the soldier of selfless sacrifice. You know, he ain't in it for the glory. There's no glory in combat.
No.
There's no glory in war. It's a hard, bloody task that will leave you carrying the burden of memories of things that no one should see, especially when you're 18 or 19 years old. The soldiers are the same. I have counted it a privilege to have been allowed to stand beside them then, to stand beside them today, and they're my brothers. What can I say?
Joe, you've got a blog. You write a column, I don't know if it's weekly or daily, on the Internet. And I'm going to ask you to do something. In these interviews that I do, as I'm doing with you, and I'm talking with grunts and I'm talking with docs, I hear this phrase over and over again. And I got to tell you, it messes with my mind. They say, I was just doing my job. I can't process that. Is there any way that you can put it down in words that will allow me and others that I know to process that? I was just doing my job.
Well, what they're saying is the training took over. In the heat of battle, in the worst of combat, your training is what will save your life. You start doing things automatically because it's almost impossible to think.
I've heard that many times.
In battle, in the smoke, in the confusion, men dying all around you, people screaming for their mother. it is just that, the training and a modesty. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've interviewed soldiers, fighter pilots. They will sit there for hours and tell you what the guy on their left did, what the guy on their right did, and they don't want to tell you what they did.
And that goes in my position of trying to get guys to be interviewed. And I have to try to persuade them, you're not going to talk about yourself because you're not the only guy that did these things. You're going to represent a whole bunch of other people. And that's the only way I get some of them to agree to come on the air.
Well, you do that or else you find the guy on the left to tell you what the guy on the right did.
That's it, right?
That's it.
And I've had that.
They are modest heroes. Our soldiers, our Marines, our airmen, our sailors, our Coast Guard guys.
Our own Dale Throneberry was a helicopter pilot over there, and he did something that was just remarkable. And I wanted to do a program on Slicks, the helicopter pilots. And I said, Dale, you don't get to do this interview. You're going to be one of the guests. I'm going to interview you. And I wanted him to tell a story about what he did, how he got his helicopter down through triple canopy jungle, having to go from hole to hole in the canopies to get a wounded grunt off the ground. And he said, well, he jiggled it around a little bit and went down and got this guy. I almost dove across this table and grabbed him by the throat. I mean,
Well, helicopter pilots are not necessarily the most modest of men. And I've heard some tales from them that...
many of them true.
You know, you have to take with a grain of salt. But they're great, great soldiers. They always came when you called.
Down to those green tracers.
You call, we haul.
They used
to have cards printed with that on them.
Right.
And I love them. You know, I hated them when they dropped me off in some god-awful place where people were trying to kill me. But they would come back to get you when it was all over. And I loved them when they gave me a ride out.
They were heroes. There's no two ways about it. The guys that went in there, like the guy that took you in to play me and the guy that took you into LZ X-ray.
Bruce Crandall earned a Righteous Medal of Honor. I rode in his chopper into X-ray, and 3 days later I rode in his chopper out.
How many choppers did he go through in that first night?
I think he went through three.
Isn't that something?
Bruce and I are still best friends today. You make friends in a situation like that on a battlefield. And if you can find them after the war is over, you got a friend for life.
You've shared something that others have not shared, others will never understand. We're winding this down. You got about 30 seconds to give a last thought of your own, if you wish.
It's only that I am so thankful that, one, I was allowed to survive, to write the stories, to tell the stories, to try to tell the truth about the American soldier. No finer, more noble creature, in my view, than just your plain, ordinary grunt existing in a hell that is combat, and somehow making it through, taking care of his brothers on his right and left, never worrying about himself, willing to stand up and go to certain death, trying to save a friend, a buddy.
Joe, thank you.
Somebody he doesn't even know.
Joe, thank you very much for all the time you've given us on Veterans Radio. I'm going to be coming back in the future and asking for more time. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Join us again. See you next program.